It's great to be here, and as Tim said, and thank you, Tim, for that gracious introduction. This is home for me. This is where I literally grew up in this building, right? Well, that part of the building, anyway. Met my wife here, and VBS, with sort of watered-down cherry Kool-Aid and knockoff Oreos, and running around what used to be a yard right here. And so, yeah, I lived right up Mink Shoals. My dad owned an auto shop just right down the road, which is now a convenience store. But it is literally like coming home in every sense of the word. And I'm just happy to be here. I'm always happy to be here. Some assembly required. Have you ever bought anything with that on it, with that stamped on it or written on it? We all have. I can remember one Christmas many years ago, we got Jamie a dollhouse, and right on it, some assembly required. So we waited for her to go to bed, and which was probably, who knows, 11, let's say it was 11. Well, the some assembly required was finally finished somewhere around 4 a.m. Some assembly required. Felt like all assembly required. So when I was getting ready for this sermon, just on a whim, I decided to Google some assembly required, or partial assembly, or partially assembled. And one word that kept popping up was IKEA. Now, IKEA is, a furniture store. I think the translation of the word is marital problems, because IKEA is where married couples go to develop marital problems. And so apparently those troubles come home with them with this sort of partially assembled furniture. Because I read report after report after report of the screws don't fit, I had to use a hammer. That's my favorite one. I had to use a hammer because the screw didn't work. And so in all fairness to IKEA, it was really clear that the fault was not IKEA's all the time. But you just had these things. And finally, and so many people frustrated, I just returned it because I couldn't get it together. And then my personal favorite was an online bike shop that they, like if you order a bike online, it comes partially, right? It comes partially assembled. And their tagline is, even a 12-year-old can assemble our bikes. Well, from reading some of the comments, I get it. I came to the conclusion that 12 years must be the maximum. And if you're over that, you can't do it. Because people would come and say, I don't know what kind of 12-year-old engineers they have at that place, but I'm not getting anywhere with this. And so, some assembly required. It's like a warning. Now, why am I talking about this phrase, and why am I talking about all these kind of things? The reason I am is because one of the verses in this text is a really well-known verse for Christians. Maybe not the whole entire text, maybe not all the verses 12 through 18 of chapter 2, but one verse. In fact, it's not even a whole verse, it's just part of a verse, is really well known. And that is, work out your salvation with fear and trembling. We all sort of know this verse. If you asked a Christian, hey, have you ever heard this verse? They would say yes. And if you would say, so do you remember the verses kind of around it? I think it would be maybe not so much. And if you would say, do you remember kind of Philippians, maybe like what Paul's been talking about up to that point? Right, maybe not so much. Now, they might remember, and I think most of us would remember, well, because it's God who works in you, both to will and to something, work, pleasure, something like that at the end, right? So we would remember because it's God who works in you. But we would really remember, work out your salvation with fear and trembling. And the fact is the way we often read that, even though we may claim, and we do believe, and we claim often that we believe that salvation is by grace through faith in Jesus alone, apart from our works, past, present, or future, we come to a verse like this, and practically speaking, in our conversations about it, and more likely in our own thoughts about it, we kind of read this verse like, when it comes to salvation, some assembly required. Nobody would say they think that. I don't know anybody that would say they think that, but we act like it. We act like when it comes to salvation that some assembly is required, even though we claim to believe that's not true. It's a pretty common interpretation or explanation of this verse. I've heard this a lot. You got to work out what God's worked in you. That's a fine phrase other than it being false. Right? I mean, apart from the fact that it's not right, it's perfectly an okay explanation of this verse. It's just got that one minor problem of being incorrect. You got to work out what God has worked in. First of all, what does that even mean? You got to work out what God's worked in. Well, I think I know what people mean by saying stuff like that, but the fact is it does end up sounding like, here's what happens. God saves you. He starts this thing. He puts you together and then steps back and says, okay, I did my part. Now you do your part. And now somebody might jump in and say, he gives us a spirit. I said, yeah, he does. I affirm that completely. But does God give us his spirit because our salvation is some assembly required? And then what does that mean, work out? Does that mean that we sort of like partner up with the Spirit and we get this partnership together that we can kind of build our salvation up that God started? I don't think it does. And the reason I don't think it does is because Paul's already said in this book that that's not what happens. This command in Philippians 2 is based on a promise that Paul has already given, that we also know, but we sometimes don't put together. That promise is found in Philippians chapter 1, verse 6. I am sure of this, that he who began a good work in you will bring it to completion at the day of Jesus Christ. Paul's already put that on the table, that he's 100% confident that the God who started a work in you, he himself, or he doesn't say the God who, I'm completely sure of this, that he who began a good work in you will bring it to completion with your partnership at the day of Jesus Christ, or with your sort of added bit kicked in at the day of Jesus Christ. That is not what Paul says. He is absolutely confident that God will finish what he started. When it comes to salvation, we have to be really, really clear about this. There is no idea of some assembly required. In fact, when it comes to salvation, it is all assembly required, and it's God who does all the assembling. We need to be crystal clear about that. It is all assembly required on God's part, not some assembly required on our part. So again, it comes with this promise that he who began a good work in you will complete it. That is a promise. And then that promise is restated here in this verse, in this text of ours, where he says, because it is God who is working in you. He doesn't say, because it's you who are working in you. He says, it's because God is working in you. Now, part of the problem here, not problem, part of the issue here is, what do we think the word work means? In this, and I'll show you, but in this text, the word work means live it out. Not like work it, like build it. Not work it, like construct it. Not work it like it's partially finished and you need to put in your bit. It is live it out. Now, if you're thinking, so what does that mean? I have to live, what do I have to do? Well, the great news is, in good Paul fashion, he never tells us what to do without telling us what that looks like. And he's made it really clear. So you don't have to think, so work out myself, what do I need to do? What are the things I need to do? Well, the great news is, all you got to do is read Philippians. Because what Paul's talking about at the beginning of, sorry, what Paul's talking about here in Philippians chapter 2, 12 to 18, he is on the same exact topic that he's been chasing down at least since the beginning of chapter 2. And that is where he sums up the entire Christian life like this: live for other people. That's it. Look at it with me. The beginning of chapter 2. For if there is any encouragement in Christ, any comfort from love, any participation in the Spirit, any affection and sympathy, complete my joy by being of the same mind, having the same love, being in full accord and of one mind. Do nothing from rivalry or conceit, but in humility count others more significant than yourself. Let each of you look not only to his own interests, but also to the interests of others. You want to know what living out your salvation looks like? It's that. It is exactly that. It is living for other people. It is putting other people ahead of yourself. It is living for the good of others rather than your own good, first and foremost. Now, the reason I'm so confident, and I keep repeating this, the reason I'm so confident that this is true is because this is exactly what Paul is saying. He doesn't just say, hey, work out your salvation, now throw it around, let's have a round table about what all this looks like. He's been telling them. And then, between the verses I just read and our text today, he gives the ultimate, final, absolute, eternal example of what this is. When he says, have this mind in you, which is also already yours in union with Jesus, who, and then goes on to say, who, though being God, did not exploit that. He didn't use that for his own gain. He didn't use it for his own purposes, but rather did what? Became a servant and became obedient, even unto death, even death on a cross, so that God has highly exalted him. So in other words, what did Jesus do? Jesus came, and though he was God, he lived and died for others. That's why Paul has that. I mean, there's more to it than that, but that's why Paul has that big part in there about Jesus and what he's done. Between put the interests of others above yourself, because Paul kind of is laying on the line. And that is, if we do not take seriously this idea of living for others as the essence of what the Christian life is, basically what we're practically saying is this: I mean, that's good for Jesus and all, and I'm happy that Jesus did it, but you know, it's kind of his job. It's Jesus' job to live and die for others. But for me, I mean, I'm busy. I've got things I need to do. I need to be right. I need to win. I need to show other people that I know what I'm talking about. I've got to stake my claim. No, everything that Paul's talking about here, it all just fits together. And then when he comes to this part, so work out your salvation with fear and trembling, he's already told us, what does this look like? He's not saying, like, make a list of works that you need to do to finish your salvation up. He's like, no, he just said it. Live for other people. It's not actually more complicated than that. The Bible sums it up, really, and Paul sums it up like this too in Galatians, that is, love your neighbor as yourself. That's what it looks like to work out, to live out your salvation. And again, I'm not always confident about a lot of things, but I'm really confident about this because Paul makes it just so clear. But one of the things that we've kind of done is we'll take this one verse out of here, work out your salvation, and then we turn that into, even though we might say we don't, we turn that into sort of like salvation initially by grace alone, and then sanctification, or whatever you want to call it, is done by works. That is false. The first thing that Paul is doing is he's calling us to believe this is true. You want to know how to live out your salvation? You have to first believe and continue believing that God is the one who will complete the work he started in you. And that he's the one working in you. So if you want to figure out, like, how do I live out my salvation, you believe that God tells the truth. And you don't sort of fall back on, well, I better kick my butt in. Unless you've sort of found like a lot of success in doing that, which if you're anything like me, you haven't. So there's sort of three things that we're going to go through really quick today. And the three things are this. Number one, if we're going to read this text, we have to understand, first and foremost, that Paul makes it crystal clear that from first to last and everything in between, you are God's work. And God calls us to live that salvation out by living for other people. In the same way, or mirroring or reflecting the way Jesus lived and died for us, we're to look like that, not less. And the second thing is this. In this text, Paul doesn't give them three things to do. He gives them one thing to do, which we've been talking about, and then sort of the two things that flow from it here. And one is, do everything without grumbling and complaining, or, to put it in another way, live out your salvation so that you'll be content and peaceful in the world. That's sort of the thing that flows from it. This idea of living for others results in us being content and peaceful among ourselves, and just as importantly, in the world that we live in, among whom Paul says we shine like lights. And then the third thing is, it frees us up to live lives that are filled with thankfulness and gratitude, regardless of our circumstances. And how can you be thankful? And we'll look at this at the end. How can Paul in prison be thankful? And how can he tell the Philippians, his good friends, hey, you should be thankful for me while he's in prison? And he's not going to come out, because they can be confident that God is working in Paul, that God is working in them both to will and to work for his good pleasure, and he will finish what he started. So therefore, they're free so that they are not defined or shaped or destroyed by their current circumstances, which at this point for Paul are not good. So work out your salvation. Now, we do need to talk about the fear and trembling bit. What does that mean? Because I'm afraid that some of us, we read that, and what we think is it's like God's threatening us. You better work out your salvation, or I'm going to be all over you so fast it's going to make your head spin. Now, again, we don't talk about God that way, and we never tell people that that's what we think God is like. And if people would say, hey, what's the Christian faith like? Explain your view of God. You would never say that God is in heaven waiting for me to trip up so he can jump all over me. But we read sometimes a phrase like this, fear and trembling, we're like, God's going to jump me. He's going to get me. Going to get you. The minute you trip up. So here's three things it is not. Number one, it is not living, fear and trembling that Paul is talking about here, is not living as though God is always out to get you the minute you slip up. And to say, told you so, I knew it. I knew it, I knew it, I knew, I knew if I just sort of started this thing that you'd ruin it. No, 1,000 times no. Second, and I've already said it, God is not threatening us. Third, the fear and trembling that Paul is talking about here is not, for example, I'll give you an example from the Bible, it is not the fear and trembling that Adam and Eve felt after they ate from the tree that God told them not to. And God came looking for them. Adam, where are you? And Adam says, I heard you coming and I hid because I was afraid. That is not the fear and trembling that Paul is talking about in this text. It is not sort of walking around every day thinking, God's going to jump me the second I mess up. What the fear and trembling is this. So it's a, you know, fear, the fear of the Lord is a huge topic in the Bible. And we can't unpack the whole thing, so I'm just going to cut to the chase. What is it? Number one, it is living every day with the reality that the one who is working in you, the one who has to do with you, the one who sent his son to die for you, completely and fully and who rose again for you is the God who created the entire universe and is the God of all things, is the King of everything. He is the one before whom we are living. He's God. So when it comes to God, if you think about it, when God shows up in the Bible, what do people do? Like people who love him and that he loves, what do? They don't sort of run up and like bro hug and fist bump him. What do? They bow before him. Why? Because he's God. And he's awesome. And he's the one person that we can literally use the word awesome and not be exaggerating. He's their God. And Thomas, when he recognizes that Jesus is who he says he is, what does he do? Bows down before him and says, "My Lord and my God." That's the story. In other words, it is recognizing who God is and that that God is right this second working in you. The second thing is, the fear and trembling is an acknowledgement and confession of our own inability to save ourselves, left to ourselves. I always like to say this, that every command is first an opportunity for us to confess and turn to God with open hands and confess our inability through our own strength, through our own works to save ourselves. It is our own inability to successfully work our salvation should be a source of fear and trembling. Because left to myself, if this really is work out your salvation that God has started, I can tell you personally, I'm done for, I'm finished. But it's this recognition that it's the fear and trembling of knowing that if left to myself, I'm done. And third, it is the reality of children living under their father. In verse 15, children of God. Now, I'll just give you an example. My dad was a tough guy. When he was barely 18, he spent a day on the beach. The beach was called Normandy. 18. And then he fought his way across. He was shot up. And then he came home and he started a business. He ran a business for over 40 years. He was a tough guy. He was also a compassionate and sweet and loving man. And understanding. And I came to realize over time, more and more and more, very, very, very patient. But he was a tough guy. And he was my dad. And when I related to my dad, I knew he loved me. And I knew there was nothing he wouldn't do for me. And I had a great relationship with him. But he was always my dad. And there was a certain amount of, I don't mess with him. I don't push him. I tried a few times. Because he's my dad. And that's the idea here, that God is our father. And we live under him as his children. And it's appropriate for children to be before their father with this healthy fear and trembling, recognizing who he is and also recognizing what he does for us and what he promises. So rather than think of fear and trembling as like terror and anxiety and grief, think of it as a call to live out your life before this God who bought you, who saved you, who created the whole universe, and who did this not because he owed you something, but because he loved you. And now calls us to do what? To live in a way that's appropriate to that relationship. Not to make that relationship happen, not to make it good, but to live it out. To put it into practice. Now, there's lots of ways that we could figure out and talk about how to apply this. But this, let me ask you one simple question. in terms of living out this salvation before this God who bought you and living for others. On a typical day-to-day basis, what do you leave in your wake? In terms of the people who have had contact with you. When people have had contact with you during the day, do you find yourself at the end of the day having had conflict after conflict after conflict with people? Do you find, generally speaking, at the end of your day or at the end of your, at the end of your conversations or interactions with other people, that you go away having been in an argument with them and that this is sort of frequent? Or maybe you go away, do you go away generally sort of irritated with how nobody seems to get it the way you do? And that you alone seem to be right in this, and other people are sort of just to be pitied because of what they're doing and what they're insisting on and what they're saying. Do you find yourself in that situation a lot? Where you come away thinking that you're right and they're wrong, and you're constantly in conflict with others? Let me tell you something right now. You are not living out your salvation with fear and trembling. You are putting yourself ahead of others. You are trying to assert yourself over others. You are not deferring to others. You are not living with this mind in you, which was in Christ Jesus, who, though was in the form of God, did not count equality with God a thing to be exploited, but took on the form of a servant for you. You're not living like he did. And so that's just an easy sort of barometer for us. What do we leave in our wake after we meet with people? And if you're like, I leave people better off because I've told them what's right. Well, if you go home and you feel just have this filled with this sense of I'm right, that's another thing. That's another sign to you that maybe you just don't realize what you've left in your wake. But on the other side of it, God is not calling you to like superhuman feats. He's simply calling you to give yourself to those. He's calling you to take the opportunity that you have every day to give yourself for other people, for their good, so that you are a positive sort of force in their life, that you are something in their life that encourages them, that builds them up, that accepts them, that doesn't feel the urge every second to fix them through instruction constantly. Think about it for a second. What if God had come and thought, okay, I'm going to go, you know what I mean, I'm going to go down there and I'm going to find the people who are like me, who are right all the time. And I'm going to find the people who have my interests. I'm going to find the people who are into what I'm into. I'm going to find the people who are sort of morally like me, upright like me, and I'm going to save those people. I'm not going to ask for a show of hands, but if we did have a show of hands, who would raise their hand right now as being pretty confident that you would be among them? None of us would be. So God is simply calling us to say, hey, look, you know what the Christian life is? It's a life that reflects. You know what working out your salvation is in fear and trembling? It's a life that is simply wherever you are, whatever your situation is to live for other people. This is the opportunity that God has given. God has given us the opportunity to do what? To live like Christ for the sake of other people. So that our salvation, which is a gift, is what? It is a gift to everyone. That God is completing this work in us of doing what? Causing us to live for others. With these two sort of results that I mentioned before. The first one is, we will live out our salvation with fear and trembling so that we can be content and peaceful. Which of course is the opposite of grumbling and complaining. And notice what he says. Do all things without grumbling or questioning, that you may be blameless and innocent. Notice he doesn't say, work out your salvation with fear and trembling, do all things without grumbling, this will make you blameless. You'll make yourself blameless. No, what he's saying is this. What he's saying is, so you'll be blameless. There'll be no blame on you because you've lived out your salvation. In other words, what Paul is doing is he's calling us to live in such a way that recognizes that in the sight of God, in Jesus, we are blameless because of Christ. And he's calling us to live that out so that we are blameless in our dealings with other people. So that rather than being agitated and irritated all the time and grumbling and complaining all the time, we are content and peaceful, both among ourselves and also in the world, among whom Paul says we shine like lights in the world. And he does say crooked and twisted. Now, what does he mean by this? There's some translations that say crooked and perverted. And if that's your translation, let me assure you, Paul's not saying among those perverts. What he's looking at, and in the Bible, like, this is like when Jesus says faithless and crooked generation. It's not just messed up, which it is. It's not just a general commentary on how the world is messed up. It doesn't really take a lot of social insight to figure out that the world is messed up. What it is this twisted and crooked in terms of it is a twisted and crooked representation of God's intention for the world. Right? They're always speaking biblically. They're never just speaking generally. And so we're able to look at the world as always a twisted or corrupted or upside down version of what God intends. And our job in that is not to just react to it. Our job in that is to do what? Is to shine light on it. And we can only shine light on it if we're to some degree living for it. That is living for the people around you. Doesn't mean you become like them, but you shine light on them. Not just add darkness, not just add commentary, but you shine light on them. Now, don't get me wrong. Paul is under no illusions. He's not Pollyanna. Paul does not live in a culture where he's allowed to be Pollyanna about the world, right? Paul is in a culture and under a government that is completely restrictive. Paul's in jail. There's a whole lot of other Christians getting ready to go to jail. He's not under the illusion that that the world is just looking for a big, smiley, warm Jesus hug. He understands the culture he's in. But yet, he's saying, in this culture, we're meant to shine like light in the darkness. And that's this vision. And this is another thing. So holding firm to the word, don't just think of it as holding firm. Think of it as holding it out. Not just confessing it. I said not just, because we do. It's not just confessing it and keeping it to ourselves and talking about it in here. It is that. It's holding it out to the world. And holding it out to the world doesn't only mean what we say to the world. It's how we live in it. Shining light in it, being an actual light in the darkness. That's how we hold it. You want to know how to live out your salvation? Be light in the world. Like Jesus, right? I recall him saying something like, I'm the light of the world. And so we're being called to follow this example that Christ has given us ahead of us so we can do what? We can be light, we can be Jesus in the world for others, the witnesses of Jesus. And in that, find, rather than grumbling and complaining and anxiety, contentment and peace. Understanding that this work is not ours, that God is the one who does the work, and we're not under this pressure to make it happen. We just have the freedom to go be light in the world, confident of what? However the world accepts you, however they react to you, you're confident in what? That he who began a good work in me will complete until the day of Christ Jesus. Regardless of the reception I get. And finally, to live with joy and gratitude. That's the second result of this salvation of life and joy, this salvation of that we live out before others. The final thing here is joy and gratitude in all situations. As Paul says, I want you to do this, holding fast to the word of life, so that in the day of Christ I may be proud that I did not run in vain or labor in vain. So Paul's confident. He's not saying, hey, I need you to do this so when I get to the end, Jesus will give me the thumbs up. Remember, I'm confident that he who began a good work in you will finish it till the day of Jesus. And so here Paul envisions this, you keep this up because my work in you is going to show not to be useless. And he even says, I mean, be proud of you. And he even says, if I'm poured out like a drink offering, in other words, if I lose my life for your sake, if I never come out of this jail for your sake, I'm glad. And rejoice with you all. Now, is Paul glad that he's in jail? Is he like, this is great? Like, so when there was like little Saul, when he was like 5 years old, and his uncle said, Saul, what do you want to be when you grow up? He's like, prisoner. No, Paul's dream in life was not to become a prisoner. He's not like, man, everything I wanted to be as a kid. No, but how can he be thankful in prison? Not because prison's great, but because he's confident, he can be confident in prison. He can be confident that in prison he is shining like a light in the world, and that he who began a good work in him will complete it until the day of Jesus. And that the one who's working in him, it is God who works and wills according to his good pleasure, regardless of the circumstances he's in. And then he says the same thing to his friends. Likewise, you should also be glad and rejoice with me. He's not saying to them, hey, friends, guess what? I want you to throw a let's celebrate Paul's in prison party. Right? I can't be there for my birthday, so have a big cake or whatever they ate in the first century and write on it, yay, Paul's in prison. No. He doesn't want them to be glad that he's in prison. He wants them to rejoice, that he can rejoice and give thanks that he's in prison for their sake. This is what the thanks is. Paul's glad. He's rejoicing that for the sake of other people, he has lost his freedom. He's not psyched that he lost his freedom. He's happy and content and thankful that if the cost of living for others was losing his freedom, he is glad to do that. In other words, Paul is simply applying the teaching that he's giving them to himself. He's just applying it to himself. That's why he can be happy. That's why he can be content. Even though his life is going off the rails, he can still be content and think, you know why I'm content? I'm content to live for others, even if this means the loss of my own life. Now, we need to make sure that we don't push back against this as seeing somehow ourselves and our circumstances and the stuff we're into is somehow an exception to these things. I can promise all of us, including myself, that we are not exceptions to what Paul is calling for here, that our situation is not such that this doesn't really apply, or that in our situation it has to be applied by doing kind of the opposite. I'm in a situation where I've got to put myself first for the good of others somehow. I'm in a situation where I have to make sure other people are correct and other people come around to the right way of thinking. Because my situation's different than Paul's. I promise you it is not. And if you're here today and you're hurting, if you're here today and you're anxious, if you're here today and you're suffering in any kind of way, if you're here today and you're wondering what God is really up to and everything that's going on in your life and in the world, this is the good news for you, is that God has set you free. God has set you free from being defined by, shaped by, formed by, and informed by your circumstances. What God is doing is he's shaping and informing us by this great word of promise, that he who began a good work in you will complete it. and that whatever it is you're going through cannot overwhelm it. And that our own attempts to kind of work it out in our own way, even those things cannot overwhelm it. Because it's a promise from God. And so with that promise, I'll draw this to an end. It's fear and trembling, understanding that it's before the living God of the entire universe. It is before Him that we are living. And it's fear and trembling, understanding what happens when we're left to our own devices. And it's thankfulness, understanding that God has said, I'm not leaving you to your own devices, but I'm going to work in you to will and to work according to my good pleasure, to bring you fully formed in the image of Jesus on the day He returns. That's a promise. And it's not a promise where God's like, I need you to connect part A to part B to part C to make this happen. It's living out salvation that is focused on other people and not on ourselves. It's this amazing freedom that we don't have to be anybody. You don't have to build your identity. You don't have to be someone. You can just be you who God created and look at your life as an opportunity to live it and spend it and expend it for others because you got nothing to prove. You've got nothing that you got to make yourself into. God has accepted you in Jesus. You can't make yourself into anything better than that. So you have this freedom. A freedom from grumbling and complaining. Freedom for contentment and peace. And freedom to live with gratitude. Understanding that when it comes to salvation, it is never some assembly required. For your part, it is no assembly required. Because ultimately it is all assembly required, and God is the one who assembles you from the top to the bottom and every way in between, and will finish that work that He started because He promised it. Let's pray. Father, I pray that we will take this to heart, that it won't just be words, that You will drive it deep into our hearts, not just once, but every day. And Lord, save me from the hypocrisy of talking to others about stuff that I then go and quickly forget. Lord, shape and form us according to Your will. Shape and form us according to Your promise in Jesus. Give us the grace of contentment and peace and thankfulness and gratitude. In Christ's name, amen.